You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Like many children of Holocaust survivors, Arianna Neumann knew nothing of her father's story of survival during the Nazi era. Growing up in her native Venezuela, foreign journalists heard no stories from her industrialist father about his own early life, and only a few remote clues. One was a box that included a photo, an ID that used the name of a Czech chemist, Jan Sebesta. And that was the first major step in unearthing her father's story of survival, an amazing story of survival by hiding in plain sight. Because the Czech Jew, Hans Neumann, was Jan Sebesta, and he worked in a German chemical factory in Berlin through the duration of the war. Neumann and his brother survived the war and immigrated to Venezuela. Unfortunately, 23 other members of his family perished. This amazing story was tracked down and told by Arianna Neumann in her book When Time Stopped, a memoir of my father's war and what remains. It's published by Scribner. Neumann is a former foreign correspondent who worked for the Daily Journal based in London. Her writing has also appeared in The European. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Arianna Neumann, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, When Time Stops, tells the story of your investigation of your father's family. You grew up in Venezuela. Your father was a successful industrialist, and you really knew very little about his life growing up in Europe until you ran across a box with your father's photo, but an ID with a very different name, a Czech name, Jan Sebesta. This was the first inkling of a story that only slowly unfolded. Tell us a little bit about how this story unfolded to the point where you decided to write about your father's story.
Well, I think I always knew there was something mysterious about my father. So growing up in Venezuela, there was always something slightly different, slightly off. We had this beautiful life in sort of a tropical country that was filled with promise. And my father was really engaged in the present, but he never, ever spoke about the past. So all I knew about him really as I was growing up was that he had emigrated from Czechoslovakia to Venezuela in 1949 and that he had emigrated with his brother. And there was absolutely no talk about his life before, about what he had left behind, about any other family members. So what I found this ID card as a child detective. And I think finding this card with a photograph of my father and someone else's name all of a sudden brought out into a relief all these other little instances. So obviously the fact that he never spoke about his past became much more relevant. And he would wake up sometimes screaming in the middle of the night. He was having terrible nightmares and he would be screaming in a language that I didn't understand. So I knew there was a mystery and I knew there was a mystery I had to solve. And it wasn't actually until he died. So my father died after a series of strokes in 2001. And he had been a collector of things. And yet when I went down to sort out all his papers, he had cleaned everything out and he had left me this box with the ID card that I had found as a child detective. And the box was just filled with his documents from World War II and from his time in Berlin.
And, we should mention that box, when you found it as a child, it disappeared after it was discovered that you'd looked in it.
It did. It had been left in the library. My father had moved it from the room where he repaired watches to the library. I found it. I ran to my mother. I said, you know, we're living with an imposter. This guy is not who he says he is. And I realize now that was a peculiar thing to say from for a daughter about her father. But I suppose that's because I always knew there was something, a little mystery there. And the box disappeared. My mother says she didn't move it. I presume she must have told my father, and my father moved it away. And actually, I have no idea to this day where he kept it hidden. It wasn't until, you know, 20-some years later that I found it again. And that set me a journey of, I mean, I wanted to solve his mystery. And as I started asking questions, it became apparent that it wasn't just his mystery, but that he had a huge, vibrant family before the war in Czechoslovakia, 34 of them, and that he just had never spoken about any of them. And so as I started asking questions, all these other boxes, a bit like as if I was in a, you know, Garcia Marquez magical realism novel, started appearing, started coming my way. So I discovered these beautiful letters from my grandparents, which were astonishingly written from a ghetto, a concentration camp called Theresienstadt. And it allowed me to piece together really, you know, what my father went through during the war, what my family went through, what they were like. And, I mean, part of it was a little bit of a thriller because part of what I pieced together was my father's life in Berlin from 1943 to 1945. And I'm sure you'll agree with me, Richard, that was a pretty unlikely and really unsafe place for a Jew from Prague who was wanted by the Gestapo to go and hide in plain sight.
Yes, it was. Yes.
Yeah.
It's not unusual, though, that this story was be completely unknown to you. It's been a familiar refrain for families whose loved ones survived the Holocaust. These were just closed subject for a number of years. And it sounds like the door never, only rarely cracked open for your father to his family to help them understand him.
Yeah, I think, I think with trauma survivors, often they just construct these walls around them. And people around them learn pretty quickly not to ask any questions. So whenever, I asked a question, my father was always, I was curious. I wanted to know, how come I didn't have grandparents? How come I didn't really have an extended family? Whenever I tried to ask a question, there would just be a wall of silence, and often he'd start to shake. So I very quickly learned not to ask questions because, you're curious, but you don't want to upset the person you love. I think a lot of survivors of the camp or survivors of the Holocaust or people that live through traumatic experiences just don't really want to relive them. So I think they put these little fragments of these horrendous things that they live through somewhere in the back of their mind, and they just try to move on. And I think that's what my father did. I think he just, I don't think he forgot him, because I don't think you forget things like that. But I think he stored it really deep inside his mind somewhere. And it was just not something that he was, he couldn't have his past and his present connect in any way. He just moved on and became incredibly successful in Venezuela and was really engaged in the present.
Now, there were clues growing up for you. You recount several times in the book, I think when you were at a boarding school, somebody came up to you and says, hey, we're Jewish.
Yeah, Tufts University, yeah.
Yeah, Tufts University, excuse me. Yeah, you said another student came up and says, hey, we're Latino and we're Jewish.
That's right. I mean, actually, he's a very good friend of mine today still. And he's this Mexican kid, and he was at Tufts University with me. And it was the first week when you're sort of meeting people, and it was called orientation. And he came up to me and said, hey, we should meet because we're both Latin American, we're both Jewish, and we're both good-looking. And I'm not very good at witty replies, but I was really thrilled to manage. Well, listen, okay, so we're Latin American, but I'm not Jewish, and you're not good-looking. And we've been really good friends since that day, but I was really baffled. I thought, where did he get that Jewish thing from? I'm not Jewish. And actually, I wasn't raised Jewish. My father never spoke about religion at all, and my mother's family was Catholic. But we weren't particularly religious. But I certainly did what my cousins were doing. So I did a first communion. I went to a school with nuns. And the word Jewish was never mentioned. I now know, because obviously talking to people, that we had Catholic friends and Protestant friends and Jewish friends. And we just, it was just never, ever mentioned. And, the fact that this kid came up to me and said that was astounding. So I called my father, just let him know how I was getting on and, complain about my dorm room and whatever else one does. And I said, listen, this boy came up to me and told me I was Jewish. And he said, what do you mean? How come? Why did he say that? And I said, well, I think he thought Neumann was a Jewish last name. And he said we had Jewish blood. And then my father's voice completely changed. And he said to me, Jewish blood. You are never, ever to use that expression. That's what the Nazis said about us. And he put the phone down. So I suppose that was my first clue, really. And that was in 1988. And then there was another, I don't know if you'd call it a clue, but in 1990, so after the Velvet Revolution, the Berlin Wall had fallen, the communism in Czechoslovakia had fallen as well. And my father was invited back to visit Prague, and he told me about it. By then he was divorced from my mother, and he said, I'm invited back, but I'm not going to go. And I said, please, I'll go with you. I wanted a free trip with my dad to Europe, but I also, I also wanted to know actually a little bit more about his past. And I figured this would be the perfect time. I mean, if we went to Prague together, he was going to, of course, share his past with me. So we went in May 1990, and he just did not share a single thing. And we spent 3 days going around the city with a tour guide, going to all the sites that you would go to today, to the square, to the bridge, to the cathedrals, to the libraries. And my father just would not speak about anything. Not only that, but I have a really terrible sense of direction. And I got lost in Prague, I mean, a lot less. I seem to find my way around in Prague better than my father. It's as if he had completely erased the streets of Prague from his mind.
He was reliving a trauma is what he was doing.
Of course. Yeah. Now I know that. But then I was just completely baffled. I thought, you know, he'd lived here for 20-something years. He obviously must know Prague. Why do we keep on getting lost and walking around in circles? And it wasn't actually until the very last days. We spent 3 days just wandering around. And I kept on saying, please, can you take me to the house where you lived? And finally, the last day, our plane was later that afternoon, he said, tell you what, let's get in a taxi and I'll take you to the place where we lived before the war. And we took a taxi to the outskirts of Prague, and we went to a sort of industrial area where there was a few buildings. And there was this 19th century building, and he just very simply pointed up at the first floor, and he said, we had an apartment there. And I said, tell me more. And he said, you know, that's where we lived. You know, he was very curt with his... And I said, and were you happy there? And he said, well, we were happier in the country house. And I said, well, can we go there? And he said, no, we don't have time. And I said, so, you know, what did this family do? And he said, we had a paint factory. I said, can we go there? And he said, no, we don't have time. And then we got into a taxi back. And as we were in the taxi and we were chatting away, all of a sudden his demeanor changed. And he said something to the taxi driver and he made him stop the car. And we stopped in what I thought was actually the middle of nowhere. So we were still in the suburbs. It wasn't a particularly pretty area of Prague, even though Prague is actually stunningly beautiful. This was, you know, it just seemed like a sort of slightly residential slash industrial area, pretty abandoned. And we had stopped by an old building, which seemed to be no longer in use. There were rail tracks with grass growing around them, and there was a fence around it. And he just got off, and he got out of the car, walked towards the fence, and I sort of followed him, again, trying to figure out, okay, why on earth are we here? And as I was about to ask that, I looked at the fence in front of me, and I realized that it was swaying. And it was swaying because my father's hands were gripping the wire diamonds of the fence, and he was sobbing. So the fence was swaying with the force of his sobs. And all he could say to me over and over, he would just repeat, this is where we said goodbye. And he was so upset that I couldn't, I mean, I just said to whom, you know, what are you talking about? And he just couldn't say anything else. So I just tried to get him out of his memory because I thought it was just too painful. So that was another clue that obviously he had said goodbye to someone. I now know that he had said goodbye in November 1942 in that very train station to his father, and that he never saw him again.
My guest today is Arianna Neumann, a journalist and an author of When Time Stopped, a memoir of my father's war and what remains. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, from that box, from these small clues you had, you basically reconstructed your father's life during the war. What an amazing journey you had to take from a few surviving relatives, some who had come to the United States before war, others who survived. Where did you start to begin to find this story out?
So I started by doing, trying to piece together a family tree. And because I had very little information about the family, so I knew my father had an uncle, Richard, that I had heard about when I was a little girl that lived in San Diego, California. And Uncle Richard had died, I think, in the 70s, but he had a widow that I had met who died in, I think, in 2003. So I knew that Uncle Richard was my father's uncle, but Uncle Richard hadn't had any children. And that was pretty much all I knew. So I found a researcher in Prague who said she would help me and find out just the names of the people. So once I started getting the names and dates of birth of the people, I discovered, for example, that in addition to Uncle Rich, who had emigrated in 1938 to the U.S., I had also someone called Uncle Victor. And Victor had emigrated in 1919. And he had lived in Washington, and then I think he had lived in California for a while. And he had moved into different places in California, but he was never spoken about. And Victor had two children. And it took me forever to trace them. And I used phone books and Google and all sorts of things. And I pretty much, I mean, if you're called if your last name was Neumann and you're called Greg or Victor, you will have gotten a phone call from me at some stage in the past 5 years, because I was just desperately trying to find them. And I eventually, you know, I called about 15 of them in San Diego, because it's actually quite a common name. And they had changed their name a little bit, since their last name had only one N. So that was a little bit of a false lead. But I eventually found my cousins. And one of them actually had kept all these letters. So his father was a philatelist. He collected stamps. This was my cousin Greg. And he said, listen, I've got this box full of letters upstairs and postcards. And I've kept them because they were my father's and they were part of his stamp collection. And do you want me to send them to you? So he sent them to me in London. And that's how I pieced together, well, all the names of the other relatives as well, and how I pieced together what they went through, because these letters went from 1920, really, to about, I think the last one was from 1941. Hmm. It was really quite astonishing. So that allowed me to put together a family tree. And then I discovered that I had cousins in Czechoslovakia and that I had a cousin in France. And it was difficult to trace. It's particularly difficult when you're doing this research to trace women, because women obviously change their name when they get married, and you just lose track of them. So I'm insured. I have two girls, and I've insured, made them promise they're never going to change their names when they get married, just otherwise it become impossible to track. I mean, I did eventually track everybody, but it's just much harder with women.
But eventually you began to piece together a story from the letters. Again, your family was a successful family in Prague. Your grandfather ran a paint factory. Your father and his brother, Lothar, really amazingly, they survived the war.
They did. So they were, I suppose, lucky. It was, the family was the immediate, the little, it was my uncle, my father, and their parents, Otto and Ella. So they owned a paint factory, and they had owned it with Uncle Richard, who actually had emigrated to the U.S. So by the time the Nazis came to Prague by 1939, it was just the four of them. But my grandfather was one of eight siblings. So they had a huge extended family, and my grandmother was one of four. So there were lots of cousins and lots of other people. But my father and his brother were protected initially by my father, by his job, and my uncle, who was a little bit older than my father, he was 21 when the Nazis first came, had just married a woman who wasn't Jewish. And ironically, for a little bit of time during the war, that protected you from being sent to concentration camps. So the more Jewish you were, according to the Nazis, then the quicker you were sent off to the camps. And if you were married to a non-Jew, that made you a little less Jewish.
Right.
So my uncle Lothar eventually got a transport notice, but it was actually not till January 45. So he survived the war in Prague. And my grandparents were actually deported in 1942. And the family tried to fight the system. So initially, the people that were meant to go on the first transport, which was in May 1942, were my grandmother, my grandfather, and my father. And they just tried everything they could to get out of the transport. And they succeeded in getting my father and my grandfather out, but they couldn't get my grandmother. So my grandmother was deported with her siblings, but basically on her own. And her siblings and her were all in the same transport, which was meant to go to a horrible camp called Sobibor. And my grandmother fainted on her way to the camp in the train, and she was taken out. And she stayed behind in Theresienstadt, which was just a camp outside of Prague. And her family went on to Sobibor, where they were all shot on arrival. But my grandmother stayed alive and stayed in Theresienstadt. And my father and his father and my uncle set up a system of contraband where they would sneak in supplies into the camp of Theresienstadt. So they would sneak in food and clothing and currency and whatever they thought she could use, pretty much weekly, by just, you know, bribing couriers, basically. And out from the camp came these pretty incredible letters, which were filled with details and, you know, filled with messages, obviously, for her family, from my grandmother, for, you know, my grandfather and her sons. And then eventually in November 42, it was my grandfather's turn and my father's turn again. And that was the moment, I suppose, that my father relived when we went to Prague in 1990, because they were both sent, and they both had to register at the train station. And when people were deported, you didn't just show up at the train station and were put in the train to the next camp. You actually have to spend a couple of days registering and signing away your possessions and just being further dehumanized. And then on, you know, day two or three, you were put in this horrendous overcrowded train straight to the camps. And it was literally at the very, very last minute, when my father had already been handed in his transport ticket, that my father is saved, because he's deemed his work is deemed instrumental for the Reich. So he is taken out of the train station, and he has to leave his father behind. And actually, one of the incredible things he left me in the box is this tiny little piece of paper which says CC449 and my father's name, Hans Neumann. And that was his transport ticket. My grandfather had been 448, and my father kept this tiny, minute little piece of paper, which is so thin. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous it survived this long. And then when my father's turn came in March 43, by then he had letters from both parents saying, do whatever you have to do, but do not come here. Stay safe, but don't get deported. So his turn came. He knew there was nothing that could save him now. So he absconded from a transport, and he was then put on the Gestapo wanted list. And actually, that's still today in the records. In Prague, you can find it there, or at least certainly I found it there. And that's when my father's astounding journey began.
That journey was due in part to a friend who gave him his passport. He traveled to Berlin. He decided to hide in plain sight in Berlin with some forged documents that gave us that title, Jan Sebesta, a Czech chemist, plus a passport from his friend to get to Germany, to get to Berlin, and to hide in plain sight working on the war effort, a Jew in Berlin. Amazing.
The story that I've uncovered is just filled with these incredibly brave people. Because my family, you know, my family had no choice. They were being persecuted. I mean, they could either obey or defy, but, you know, they were being persecuted. But there's all these people around them, including my father's best friend, Denik, and they had been in chemistry school together, and they belonged to a pranksters club together, and they wrote poetry together, and, you know, they were just teenagers together. And Denik is astounding because he was not Jewish. He was sent to, like many non-Jews, to as a forced laborer from Prague to work in the war effort in Berlin. And he, jokingly, my father was hidden for a little bit in the paint factory by, again, another very brave man who wasn't Jewish, who was a paint factory manager who took a huge risk. And Stenek came in one night, and I assume with quite a lot of alcohol in their system, that he jokingly said to my dad, you know, if only you could come to Berlin and help me out, because we're so overworked. And there's a Czech saying that goes something like, the darkest shadow is just beneath the candle. And inspired by that, that saying basically, you know, if you're going to go and hide somewhere, you don't hide in the periphery of the candle where the light illuminates you. Oh, no, you go to the center of it all where the shadow is at its darkest. You go to the belly of the beast. You travel to Berlin because no one is going to look for you there, because no one in their right mind, being a Jew, would go and hide in Berlin. So that was their bet. So Zdenek really bravely lent my father his passport, and that was, you know, it was illegal to give a Jew a cigarette. So to give him a passport was just instant death, undoubtedly. And Zdenek just did it courageously I suppose out of desire to do the right thing, perhaps, you know, just for his best friend. And that was that. So my father takes this astounding journey on May the 3rd, 1943. And he has an ID card, which was given to him by his girlfriend. So it was his girlfriend who also wasn't Jewish. So if you were a Jew, then you had an ID card with a big J stamped on it. And my father's girlfriend is called Mila. Her ID card didn't have a big J. So they doctored the name, and they created this fictitious person, Jan Sebesta. And my father went with an ID that said Jan Sebesta, with a passport which had his friend's name, and he looked nothing like my father, so had a passport and a different name, which was Zdenek Tuma. And you never knew what the border police were going to ask for, you know, because the laws changed all the time, the rules changed all the time. It was pretty arbitrary. So they could have asked for both. And if they asked for both, or if they asked for the passport and then recognized that the man in the picture was not my father, they, you know, God knows what would have happened to him. So he also traveled with a vial of cyanide. And at the border crossing, he put that vial of cyanide in his mouth, just in case. And he was astoundingly lucky. because I just asked for the passports, and he just showed it to him and showed it to the border guard, and they let him through. So then he arrived in Berlin and went to the paint factory where Zdenek was working, where he knew that they needed people, and he asked to meet with Zdenek's boss, who was a big, horrible man, a Nazi called Dr. Hogan, and basically charmed his way into a job with Dr. Hogan, who then got him all the necessary permits and then who took a rather sort of liking to my father and promoted him and sort of made him part of all his experiments, so that my father was then able to pass off the information that he acquired there to the Dutch resistance so that they could pass off the information to the Allies.
Wow.
And he stayed there for 2 years. I mean, fearing for his life, I presume, at every second, because his cover could be blown at any given time. Then Zdenek, of course, came back. I mean, my father sent Zdenek's passport back, and Zdenek came back and joined him and helped him again for 2 years. He was the only one that knew that this man working at the paint factory called Jan Sebesta wasn't Jan Sebesta at all, but a Czech Jew called Hans Neumann.
At the very beginning of the book, there's a story of the Remembered in Prague, and there is all the names. And your father's name was on there when you visited in 1997.
That's right.
And gave his date of birth, and most of the time on most of the entries, it gave the date of death. But on your father's, it gives his date of birth,
yep,
but a question mark.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever ask about that to your father?
So I did, actually. And it was one of those incredible moments, and I had lots when I was doing the research, where you just thought, okay, wow, this is... So I went in 1997, and, you know, I went as a tourist. I had no idea there was any connection with the synagogue at all, and I walked down some stairs, and I looked immediately to my right as I walked down the stairs as you enter, and there were these people called Otto Neumann and Ella Neumann, and I pieced together that it must be my grandparents, and that, I suppose, by then wasn't so astounding. But then I saw my father's name, and it was his actual, it was his full name and had the date, and, you know, and there was no other question marks on the wall, because as you rightly point out, they all had dates of death. And I called my father on the phone that evening from the hotel, and I said, there's a question mark by your name. And he just said the most remarkable thing. He said, ha, because I said, why is it there? And he said, ha, I'll tell you why it's there. It's there because I tricked them, and I lived. And, you know, I just think that's wonderful, because that's exactly what he did. And he was a prankster as a teenager, and you know, that's exactly what he did. He pulled the greatest prank possible. He fooled them for 2 years. You know, he didn't change his personality. He wasn't going around. He refused to say Heil Hitler in the factory, and he refused to abide by the racial laws and had a couple of German girlfriends, which, of course, the Germans didn't like, because even though they didn't know he was Jewish, they knew he was Czech, and the Germans considered themselves superior to the Czechs, and having affairs with German women was not on. So they actually, as punishment for that, volunteered him for the fire brigade, which again was just astounding, because as the bombs were raining, the Allied bombs were raining on Berlin, and everybody ran to the shelters, my poor dad and his friend Zdenek, who also had German girlfriends, had to run out onto the streets to put away the fires and save people that had been injured by the bombs.
Foreign journalist Arianna Neumann is the author of When Time Stopped, a memoir of my father's war and what remains. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.